Good morning, everyone. Welcome to New England to the Deep South and from the heartland to Hollywood, local responses to the national call for increased access to HIV care. We're having a bit of a speaker issue, probably because of Monday morning traffic and the shuttle, but our exact middle speaker, Peter Gamache, is trapped somewhere in the streets of Boston, so he'll be coming in probably in the middle, so we may have to leap over him depending on when he comes in and then go back. But if you'll bear with us, we'll certainly start and get running through. It's cold this morning in Boston. I used to live in Boston. I forgot how cold it was. So my name is Vignetta Charles. I'm Senior Vice President at AIDS United, and I'll talk a little bit more about AIDS United in a minute. And I'm assuming that all of you are here because you are interested in HIV/AIDS and some best practices that we've learned over our now almost 4 years of grant making and service delivery for HIV/AIDS. I have to read this out loud. I'm sorry. So all presenters, the following have no relationships to disclose. So there are no financial relationships with commercial interests relevant to this presentation that have existed during the past 12 months. So the workshop objectives will describe new models of addressing access to care for people living with HIV, describe both individual and systemic barriers to effective HIV treatment engagement, and identify some areas for consideration with best practices. A little bit about AIDS United and why this group has all come together, this mishmash of organizations. Our mission is to end AIDS and the AIDS epidemic in the U.S., and we do it in three ways. We do it through strategic grant making, we do it through capacity building, and we do it through advocacy on a national and a local level. Our grant making portfolio dates back to 1987, and when we first started, we were the National AIDS Fund, actually, at the time, and we were really focused primarily on prevention, and so some, you know, behavioral interventions, you know, condom uptake in communities, and in advance of the, you know, very famous treatment cascade in about 2008 or 2009, we started to alter our investments to really focus to increase access to care for people living with HIV. As someone who's been doing prevention for 15 years at the time, we were seeing that the epidemic won't end if we don't get people who need the care in care and their viral load suppressed. So if you look at the cascade, this is actually the Gardner version of the treatment cascade, which came out in 2011. I don't know how familiar you all are with HIV, but if you're in the HIV/AIDS world at all, you've seen the treatment cascade, some version of this, pretty much everywhere in your life for the past couple of years. So this is the original one, which was done by Ed Gardner, which was a comprehensive review, which really looked at the fact that there is over a million people HIV infected. That's the estimate. And only 73% of those actually are diagnosed. Then we go down from linked to care, 36% retained in care, 29% actually need antiretroviral therapy, 22% on antiretroviral therapy, and only 19% are adherent and undetectable. More recent data from CDC has actually sort of upped that to about 25% adherent and undetectable, but as you can see, we're doing really poorly in the U.S. in ensuring that the million people who are HIV infected are actually getting the meds they need, getting linked to care, getting retained in care, and getting virally suppressed. And you can see from the bubbles, we decided for access to care, this is where we would intervene at AIDS United. And so access to care begins after people are diagnosed, and so they know their status. We're committed to filling the knowledge gaps about barriers to care. What stops them from getting linked in between that sort of diagnosed and linkage? What stops them from being retained? So implementing best retention strategies. And as we know from HIV/AIDS, it's never a one-size-fits-all. And so these are strategies, plural, right? And not everything will work for every community. We wanted to address patients' treatment needs. There's a new line of meds. Some people who have been on the new line of meds for a while need to go back to the old line of meds. And patient adherence is really dependent on people understanding their treatment. And then finally, adherence isn't just about treatment, but it's actually, you know, HIV at this point, you know, thankfully is a chronic disease. People are living longer with HIV and need to know how to manage that condition for, you know, the rest of their lives. So AIDS United Access to Care, as you can see, there are 15 networks of care up here. So these logos represent the lead organization, but each organization is compiled of a network of care of up to 10 in some cases, but a minimum of 3 organizations working together in those communities to ensure that people living with HIV get in care and stay in care. We believed in the network of care model, this collaborative model, because the people who are hardest to reach with HIV get their care and get linked in many ways. It might be through a domestic violence shelter, it might be through, you know, an asylum referral, and somehow getting linked into care isn't just about the clinical partner. And we have generally used trusted ASO partners, AIDS Service Organization partners in the communities, because they're the ones that can be the glue for those people. We have an emphasis on the hard-to-reach populations, particularly those who live in poverty and who know their HIV status but are not in care. And those are the ones that, if you look at sort of CDC estimates, people who know their status, have been out of care, and have been out of care for long windows of time, they're the hardest to link back into care. So when we're talking about the CDC cascade or the sort of national cascade, you have many people living with HIV who are of higher SES, who are able to, you know, stay in care, advance their treatment meds, and these are not the populations that we're working with. We're working with homeless people, substance abusers, men who have sex with men, who are in communities where they experience extensive stigma, undocumented immigrants, folks who don't want to be known, who don't want to be in care and stay in care. So that's the emphasis of AIDS United's Access to Care initiative. We have 3 cohorts of grantees that are funded through the initiative since 2009, so there's been many stages. The folks have come in made many stages, and we'll actually conclude with the one who's been here the longest through New York. And we really have focused on innovative approaches that are driven by the local epidemic and the gaps in linkage and retention locally. So again, not a one-size-fits-all, but saying what's working best in LA, what's working best in Chicago, what's working best in New York, and then seeing what can work, transfer to other communities. There's some common themes, though. Not surprising, nearly all have a peer navigation component. And that means that they have a person living with HIV who may resemble the communities they're trying to reach in sort of demographics, socioeconomic status, maybe come from the same community or neighborhood, that are identifying people and helping them link and stay in care. Peter Taylor. Here we go. We can move this on. Come on up, Peter. Another common theme, as I said, these are networks of care. And so this care coordination with clinical partners, a common quote, the right care at the right time, at the right location, with the right providers. And again, these are collaborative partnerships that seek to make meaningful, sustainable systems level change in the community. So these referral networks actually expand over time. So suddenly, you know, someone's referral becomes a sort of sea of referrals, and there's able for the community to be more coordinated in ways that it wasn't potentially before. There's an overarching national evaluation strategy that we work with at AIDS United. There's also local evaluation that happens for each of the projects for their site-specific questions, and all of my partners up here will get into that. But for the national evaluation, there's 3 components. So the first is sort of these client-level measures. So, of course, you know, number of clients served, the impact of the services on the lives of the clients, asking them about their major barriers to care, and sort of filling their unmet need for, you know, psychosocial barriers, addressing the psychosocial barriers, addressing their treatment needs as well. There's a cost analysis. So it looks at the type and the cost of services provided in each of the communities, and then looks and sees if that investment in the services can be identified as cost savings or cost effective to society compared to the lifetime care of treatment. And the cost analysis is actually a really critical piece for us. We at AIDS United, of course, do advocacy on the Hill. We have 3 lobbyists that work on Capitol Hill every day, and you can imagine they're talking to congresspeople, and congresspeople are like, why would I invest in HIV? Why would I direct resources, you know, again, toward Ryan White, toward, you know, sort of Medicaid expansion, to things that would, you know, benefit care for people living with HIV? And if we can say, you know, less than 1 infection averted, or however few infections could be averted, for this to be cost savings to you and your community, it really resonates. So it resonates with funders. It certainly resonates with decision makers like Congress. And then, again, for this case study piece, really talking about sort of on community level, what are we strengthening the community network of HIV/AIDS providers? A lot of times people will have the criticism, we're all working with the same people, you know, it's duplicative services, and the more coordinated folks are, then you sort of strengthen that community network. So who are we reaching? So to date, since we launched in 2009, Access to Care has enrolled over 4,000 participants. They represent the national demographic profile for individuals who are at greatest risk for HIV. I'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. And on average, the first day of diagnosis was 9 years prior to enrollment. So these people who have known they were HIV infected and then for many, many years stayed out of care for lots of reasons. Access to Care participants face a variety of structural and psychosocial needs and barriers to care. I'll talk a little bit about this. I'm going to give a little snapshot. And then early data shows there's sustained engagement in Access to Care is leading to higher CD4 and lower viral load. So that's what we want to see. Just a little snapshot of Access to Care demographic characteristics. These should be updated soon. But this was from 18 months of a subset and 1 year of another subset of the Access to Care grantees. And you can see over half are 40 and over, about two-thirds are male, and a little over half are African-American. Just another snapshot, and if we look at sort of these client services, this is looking at Louisiana, just as a snapshot. Thanks, Peter, for joining us. And if you look at, for those who were enrolled in Access to Care at baseline, only 9% had an undetectable viral load, which is what we want to see for people living with HIV. And at time two, which is at 1 year, that would jump to 32% because of the Louisiana initiative. In terms of the cost analysis, another snapshot, this again is the, can an argument be made that investment in these services provided sufficient health gains that the services could be labeled as cost savings? And so this cost analysis, if you just look at the second to last line, which actually I think is the most powerful, if you look at the cost savings threshold in this Chicago example, again, this is just a snapshot. If you look at 6 months of service delivery costs in Chicago, less than one infection would have to be averted. So less than 0.83 HIV transmissions would have to be averted for this to be cost savings compared to not doing the care. Again, this is a really powerful data point that we're able to give to policymakers, and we're hoping that more people are sort of adopting cost analysis as part of their evaluation mechanisms, because in this time when we're all strapped for cash, it's a really good defensible argument. So with that, actually, let me transition. We have many, many partners. Oh, I forgot your bio up here. As I mentioned, we have 15 networks across the nation, and we have a subset of them here today to describe some of their unique models. We're going to start with our friends, our local friends, from Boston, Massachusetts. So Jeremy Lapidus is the Program Evaluation Manager at AIDS Action Committee of Massachusetts, the hometown hero here, and he's responsible for agency-wide program evaluation, quality improvement, and research. He has an MSPH from Johns Hopkins School of Public Health, also an alma mater, and a BS from the University of Michigan. Thanks.
Thanks, Vignetta, for that introduction. So I'm not going to talk too much about our model of care here in Massachusetts, because Vignetta did a great job introducing what AIDS United is all about, and you know what all of our models are generally about is, you know, linking people to HIV care, utilizing peer services or community health workers or promoters. And so that's kind of our general model of care for all of ours at AIDS Action. We use mental health clinicians and case managers to do this as well, kind of in a team model to try to get people connected to care. So that's a little bit about what our model is, just to give you a little bit of background. We have sites in Boston and Cambridge and in Lynn on the North Shore, for those of you who know the area. It's greater metropolitan Boston area. So I want to focus on what's specific about our site and about Massachusetts, and that we've had, you know, healthcare reform here for the most part, for a little bit of time. And as the Affordable Care Act rolls out in the United States now and becomes implemented, what are some of the things that we might expect to see in some of the other places? What are some of the problems that we still face in Massachusetts, even though clients and many people living with HIV have access to health insurance? So there are three main problems that I've, kind of identified. There are certainly more than this, and you could categorize them in different ways, but I've tried to make it somewhat digestible. So client transience is one of them. Although clients may have insurance still, it doesn't mean that they're easier to reach. They change phone numbers all the time. That's, I'd say, one of our biggest things is how do you get in contact with them? We're starting to be able to use email with clients, but even so, that's still hard. They frequently change doctors. They may have insurance, but they go to one doctor, 1 month, and then, 6 months later, maybe they go to another doctor. So if we're talking about keeping clients in care, what does that actually mean to be in care? It probably means a longitudinal care with a single doctor or provider who knows you, who can engage with you. And just because clients have insurance doesn't mean that that's what they're, getting with their primary care providers. The appointment structure requires a lot of advanced scheduling for clients. And for many of our clients, they have trouble scheduling far into the future and making these sort of plans. So the appointment structure hasn't changed at all in Massachusetts. And the Affordable Care Act is not necessarily going to change that. So that's something that is definitely still a barrier. Another thing is communication between organizations. This is definitely something that AIDS United tries to focus on, is helping us create this kind of network of AIDS service providers in the Boston area. But that's still a problem. We don't always know what services are offered at other places. We don't communicate. We don't have a contact person sometimes at other organizations or clinics. There's a lot of HIPAA rules, and that's good for patient privacy protection, but also that inhibits us from sharing a lot of data that maybe we would be able to use to reach different clients who are changing their phone numbers or falling out of care. So that's still a barrier that continues. And then housing and mental health are huge barriers here in Massachusetts, in the Boston metropolitan area in particular. Housing is very expensive, and there's not enough affordable housing. So I just want to go into a little bit of detail about housing. So this is for our clients, for their housing status. In permanent housing, there's about 55%, and that means, you have a privately subsidized, or you own your home, or you rent, and it's an affordable rent. Or transitional housing, maybe you're in a program, but it ends in a couple years, or in 6 months, or so on. And then 15% are homeless. And so this is kind of this categorical definition based on where they're housing. But then we also ask clients, how stable do you consider your housing? And so you can kind of see that there is not a huge correlation between this, where they're actually housed, and if they consider their housing to be stable or not stable. So you can see in the transitional, you can see that the blue is somewhat stable, the yellow is not stable at all, and the red is stable. So even for people who are housed, a good amount of them think that they're not that stable for their housing. So this is kind of perceived housing stability. And that definitely gets in the way of HIV care, because if you are worried about your housing, you're not worried about when you're going to the doctor, you're not necessarily worried about taking your meds or able to have a place to take your meds or to have this kind of routine in your life to be able to get the care you need and to take care of yourself. So another barrier in Massachusetts still is mental health. So this is based on the Kessler. It's a 10-question scale that asks questions on anxiety and depressive symptoms in the last 30 days. And so you can kind of see that you can categorize people based on their answers to the questions. And you see that 7% all on the left is likely to be well, and all the rest are likely to have at least a mild disorder, and 45% are likely to have a severe mental health disorder. So you can see with many of our clients that there's mental health issues that definitely get in the way of care. And we've done a little bit of preliminary statistical analysis, and you can see perceived housing stability. We cross this with ever being linked to care or having attended a doctor's appointment. And that is, if you compare stable housing versus somewhat stable or stable versus not stable at all, you can see that that's significant, and that people who are stably housed are significantly more likely to get connected to care, which is not surprising, but Affordable Care Act is not going to fix this. And again, mental health was trending towards significant. We categorized it in a dichotomous variable of likely or to have a disorder or, you know, not so likely to have a disorder. And it's trending towards significant. Hopefully when we get more data and do more analysis, we'll see it. But that's where we are a little bit on some of the barriers. So what can we do to address these barriers? So for the client transients, this is some of the strategies that we employ at AIDS Action and with our partner organizations in the area. We use a team model to engage clients. This is a mental health clinician, this is a peer advocate or community health worker, and a case manager. So we talk about that. We talk about all the clients in weekly meetings, making sure that really they're not falling through the cracks, making sure we know where they are. We use kind of our database to make sure that we're having contact with clients to follow up with them. We create regular reoccurring reports and feed it back to our case managers to make sure that, you know, what they're seeing with their clients is actually what's happening and what we're seeing in the database. So we're really just kind of trying to use technology to make sure we're all on the same page here. And we place a case manager, a mobile case manager from our sites in different clinics around the cities, around the city of Boston and the metropolitan area. And this allows us to, one, kind of create that human contact with the organizations to be able to make appointments easier, to say, hey, come to an appointment on this day, I'll be there. And then also provides a link from the clinics to our services to address these housing and mental health needs. And again, and then kind of using data in a little bit. Another way is we have client progress reports for case managers to go over with their clients about how they're doing and achieving their goals. And I'm going to show a quick example here. Hopefully you can see it. So you can kind of see that it's a snapshot, and this would be printed out as a page, and case managers go over this with their clients. This is where you're at, and this is what's happened with your CD4 count in the last, you know, year and a half. This is what's happened with your viral load. Hopefully, you know, all of our clients look like their CD4 goes up and their viral load goes down. You can say these are the goals you're working towards. This is your housing status and that kind of stuff. And so it's really a check for clients on, you know, what are they working towards, where are they at, and it's also hoping to engage them a little bit more. And, you know, if you want to work towards housing, this is what things you need to do, working towards connecting to care. So addressing the communication between sites, again, there's this mobile case manager embedded in clinics. I think that's really, really important, having this really clear link between clinical, medical sites, and social service organizations. And, you know, we have memorandums of agreement, we have business agreements, and I think those kind of formalized partnerships are very, very important. We have a system of regularly obtaining clinical information from these clinics, and so we can know when the client's gone to their appointment, when their next appointment is going to be, how they're doing with their CD4 and viral load. And so that's very important. We don't have to rely on client self-report, which sometimes then can be reliable, sometimes not, but we can call them, say, hey, you have an appointment coming up. Do you need any help getting there? Do you need someone to accompany you to this appointment? So that's really helpful for us on that front. And then again, we have a monthly revision of measures of success where we do some member checking with our managers, our case managers, our peers to say, hey, this is what we're seeing. This is where our clients are mostly going to this clinic. You know, we've seen that you've accompanied, you know, 10 clients over the last month. Is that true? Do you think you've accompanied that many? Have you accompanied less or more? And so really making sure that we're all on the same page with on the organizational level and inter-organizational and with the clients as well. And so then addressing barriers to mental health and housing, we have a robust housing search program. The majority of our clients come to our agency not to get linked to care, but they come to get affordable housing. That's really what's on the forefront of their mind. So we you kind of use that as a way to, you know, we help them get housing and then also talk about these other things as well. So we have, you know, actually these giant paper carts of, you know, like hundreds of affordable housing opportunities in Massachusetts because it's a really hard system to navigate, much like the medical system, except for even more antiquated and out of date in technology. And so we have housing search groups every week for a couple hours. So clients come in then, and then we can engage them in other services as well. But really working towards their goals on housing before, you know, working towards any other goals of getting connected to care. And we provide low-threshold mental health counseling, so this is very important. We have drop-in mental health appointments, and so clients can come in, see a mental health provider, and, you know, if they don't come back for a month or two, that's okay. that can make appointments. We allow that as well, but for those clients who may be making appointments is not a good, you know, way for them to operate, we have this low threshold approach. And this is just some preliminary outcome stuff. It's only for 25 clients who were detectable viral loads at baseline. Their median was 2,000 copies per microliter, and then the follow-up for viral load was 200. So you can see that, you know, things are trending in the right direction for our clients. Obviously, it's only 25 clients for whom we have follow-up data for. Hopefully, we'll get that in the future. So in summary, this is just, I can't emphasize that enough, the placement of the mobile case manager embedded in clinics, this connection, this human connection in places for helping people make appointments and linking them to our services, utilizing data for improvement, and assisting with housing and mental health.
So unless there are any immediate clarification questions for Jeremy, we're going to actually ask you to hold your questions till the end and then move on to another unique model, which is in Louisiana. And you saw a little snapshot of their client data, but you're going to hear more about the Louisiana project from Dr. Peter Gamache, who is a research development and evaluation specialist for health services organizations, private foundations, and public service systems. In his current capacity at the Louisiana Public Health Institute, he works closely with agencies and initiatives that are primarily focused on integrating primary health care and behavioral health. His PhD is from the University of South Florida. Thanks, Peter.
Good morning, everyone. So the Positive Charge Initiative is a multifaceted linkage to care program for those who are newly diagnosed or out of care or have been lost to care. We have five interventions, including a peer health navigation intervention, a linkage case management intervention based on the ARTIS model. If you're not familiar with ARTIS, ARTIS is an antiretroviral treatment and access to services model, and it's a strength-based model. It's a CDC. Basically, if you've ever heard of wraparound, this is the CDC version of that. We also have pre- and post-release case management, HIV-specific disease intervention specialists, the DISs that we work with, the Office of Public Health, the statewide system, and the health navigation and treatment adherence intervention. So this was definitely a multi-component intervention, and it was statewide. We were not only based in the epicenters of where the epidemic is located in Louisiana, which includes New Orleans and Baton Rouge. And Baton Rouge, you may have heard, is the number one AIDS case rate among metropolitan areas in the United States. So we are definitely a huge epicenter for this issue because people are coming in late to care. And we're also in Shreveport and Lake Charles. So we got some rural areas mixed in, but we wanted to definitely center in on where the majority of the cases were being found. Majority of our clients were Black. We had 5.6% who were other, and that included mixed races, and then we also had 12.3% who were white. So this is definitely an intentional part of who was targeted for our intervention. We also had a majority, about two-thirds were male and one-third were female. We also definitely had outreach components for transgender individuals, and this is an underrepresentation because when some people check the box, they won't say, I'm a transgender person. They'll indicate male or female. So that's why sometimes you'll have a lower percentage there. And we also had the majority of clients who were heterosexual and about one-third who were gay or bisexual. And we had great data. Oh, this is definitely a feature of our program. We were linked with the Office of Public Health, the statewide surveillance system, so they were able to link up using CareWare, the HRSA database system, their mandatory lab reporting data with our clients. So there was a matching component to this. That's why we were able to pull through what was happening with all their viral load levels and their CD4 counts. So as you can see, it plummeted in the from baseline to T1. T1 or time one was the six-month mark. So we had a huge decrease in the viral load. We had a bit of a rebound, kind of like skipping rocks on a lake, from 22,000 to 40,000, and then at time three, which was the 18-month mark, then it decrease precipitously. So this is definitely a major gain from how we were able to make an impact for among our client base. And then also the dotted line is the CD4 count, so you can see it increasing in the right trend as you would hope and expect. So this is definitely a major component of something we were able to pull through from our program. And just to make a quick note about this is that not only is it health outcomes, but it's also prevention, treatment as prevention, right? So with a lower amount of viral load within someone, it decreases their ability to transmit the virus to others. So there's not only a direct health outcome impact from this program, but also an extended outcome in terms of long-term prevention. So today I really wanted to focus in on the stigma issues in Louisiana. Louisiana is the Deep South. It is a different kind of state. Stigma is very much a prevalent issue across the United States, and I've traveled all over working with community health centers all over the U.S. and in rural areas and Puerto Rico, and I have never, ever seen stigma like in Louisiana. And sometimes when you think about Louisiana, it's a party place, you know, the French Quarter and New Orleans, and it's a fun place to go and visit. That's kind of like a haven, right? So for people to go and kind of be wild and have fun and come visit, and it's a great place to come to travel to. But for somebody who's HIV positive, the policies there and the ways of thinking are very much fear-based, and it's like you've stepped back in time. So that's how I kept kind of describing these meetings that I kept going to when I talk about HIV and STIs, and people, you know, like the eyes sort of gloss over, and there's this reaction of, oh, wow, somebody here is talking about this issue. So definitely a different mindset. I want to take note about the punitive policies. So we have an HIV criminalization statute, and this is one of about, 32 states that still have this on the books. These are like blue laws or old laws that are on the books, but they're still being used in Louisiana. This law was, this statute, particular statute, was written in 1987, right? So a culture of sort of fear and misunderstanding around this issue. And this persists to the modern day. So this is why this is kind of like this thorn in our side whenever we try to raise awareness and have policy advocacy, because it's very difficult to work against a political climate of tough on crime and, you know, the punitive ways of approaching condemnation of behaviors and disease issues. So this statute, it talks about using an AIDS-contaminated object, you know, on somebody, or, you know, it has saliva in there. So it's just got a lot of, you know, weird things that are in there. And it also talks about exposure. So it's not necessarily that it's intended to, you know, prevent the direct transmission of the virus to someone else. So that would kind of understandably be something that could be punitive, where if somebody was intentionally transmitting to others, you know, that's something that you would want to maybe put a policy on. But this is about exposure. So the mere exposure to somebody else of the virus, then that puts you already in a very negative place. So let me just kind of throw a case example at this. The way that this was pushed was from the prison guards and the police, because they didn't want prisoners to, you know, intentionally give them the AIDS virus. So it says if you spit on a police officer, right, it's got all these different penalties in there. That's what it's really designed to do. So when I've talked to legislators about this, the reaction is, well, this is really, you know, something old, and this needs to be repealed. However, we're going to run up right against the police lobby. So there you go. There's the challenge. This is why it's so difficult to get rid of old, strange old laws like this. We also have the YERBIS, the Youth Risk Behavioral Surveillance Survey. This is a CDC national survey where it has multiple questions, you know, smoking and where do you wear a bicycle helmet, and a lot of different questions for high schoolers in particular. But statewide, we have a ban against any of the sexual health questions. So they don't want to know. It's just been deleted out. And when they've had attempts in the legislature, and the legislators, the hearings, people will come in and they'll, you know, start saying interesting things and waving Bibles and, you know, everything. And there's op-eds saying it's going to pornification of children, and just like really, really out of the left field reactions whenever you just try to get a public health approach to these issues. So these are the reactions you run into. We have comprehensive sex education. That's It's banned, but it's allowed, but it's banned. So we don't have a statewide prohibition against comprehensive sex education, but whenever you get to the district level, it becomes this, oh, well, you know, we can't do this, we're going to shut it down kind of reactions. We also have needle exchange policies that are punitive. So we have public health workers and our programs that are literally, you know, putting needles in their back of their cars or in their trunks, trying to go into shooting galleries where people are shooting up and trade their needles, just to reduce the disease issues around this. It's not about getting rid of their addiction, it's about reducing HIV transmission. So they're kind of on the sly, you know, doing this in certain neighborhoods, going under bridges, finding people, going into shooting galleries, working, you know, in high crime areas. So these are like salt of the earth public health peeps who are out there trying to make a difference, but they're at risk of being punished by the police by having, you know, a bag of things that they're doing, that they're bringing with them. We also have historical policies. Only as of a couple years ago, we had something called Crimes Against Nature. This was in Louisiana, and it was to ban the prostitution in the French Quarter. This is how it was designed. This is like old ships that were at port, you know, and this law was on the books for 260 years. So that just shows you the kind of the old ways that take forever to, you know, to be dealt with. And this, thankfully, was repealed. So this was a nice win for Louisiana. It was like, yeah. However, the people were required to register as sex offenders if they were punished underneath this this law. And this law basically said if there's a crime against nature, if there's any oral or anal sex that's, you know, perceived or in process or whatever. So this was a punishment against people who were prostituting in the quarters. But it was also just basically anybody. And it was particularly low-income minority women this was used against, and homeless individuals. And then we also have wonderful Anti-Affordable Care Act, you know, issues that are in Louisiana. And when I tried to advocate to the Senate Finance Committee and say, you're going to pay pennies now or dollars later, this is, you know, from a cost standpoint, this makes no sense that you wouldn't take this kind of money. And we're trying to bring in federal money constantly. Why would you, turn this down? It's a very much a political mess. So people will say, well, we are anti-Obamacare, or, you know, we don't want this for our state because it's actually going to cost us. And they found all kinds of ways to, you know, use the numbers to project out 10 years, even though it's, you know, free for the first 3 years federally. So we definitely have this kind of interesting policy challenges that we're constantly dealing with. And then I just wanted to speak very quickly about systems integration. It was very important that we had LAFIE, which is a Louisiana Public Health Information Exchange. And this is basically a statewide surveillance system, very innovative, where we had the public hospitals, the LSU hospitals, that were the charity hospitals. And basically, if somebody came in and they broke their leg or they went to the emergency room and they've been lost to care, they would get into their EHR system, and it would go out to a centralized database and match with the state surveillance data, knowing if they had a HIV-positive diagnosis. And then it would come back to the doctor's screen, and it would basically raise a red flag. Oh, has this person, you know, been treated, or have they been engaged in care? So there were privacy concerns and other challenges for implementation, but this has been a huge win for public health because it's another flag, it's another way to basically make sure that people are linked into care. So we definitely had some advancements there. I mentioned CareWare, the surveillance data that we were able to pull through, and the reminder systems in terms of out-of-care lists that were generated by providers. So that was a definite gain for our program. And our lessons learned are that positive charge raised the visibility of the importance of linkage to care for people living with HIV in the state. It provided a platform for other access to care initiatives, enhanced relationships and coordination. This was definitely key among the positive charge partners that you saw earlier on the earlier statewide slide. And also the importance of developing and updating intervention workflows. That was definitely a major gain. Thank you.
Thank you. thanks, Peter. And so you can sort of see this is definitely not the one-size-fits-all, right? So we had, you know, we started with hometown Massachusetts, which has the Affordable Care Act, has had Affordable Care Act for 10 years, and, you know, housing is still an issue. Then you have Louisiana, which has these, like, amazing systems integration for surveillance, which is, you know, a model for the nation, but then is plagued by the sort of deep stigma that, you know, sort of challenges folks. And then now we're going to go to the heartland, to St. Louis, and talk about challenges that they're having with exactly what Louisiana is successful about. And we're going to hear from Steve Holdsworth. And Steve began his work in HIV AIDS in 1983 as volunteer at AIDS Action Committee. And among many other activities, Steve has been an AIDS activist with ACT UP, a mental health counselor for Sarah Discordant Couples, and a Ryan White case manager. Steve spent more than a decade in academia as both an administrator and a faculty member before returning to HIV-related work in 2006, and we're so grateful. Steve is currently the program manager for the Beacon Project at St. Louis Effort for AIDS, holds a BA in religion from Bowdoin College and a master's in education and counseling psychology from Cambridge College. He was an AVAC Prevention Roar Fellow in 2011-12 and received Community Educator Awards to attend the annual conference on CROI in 2012 and 2013. So thanks, Steve.
So I want to start with my 3 points, because sometimes in the minutiae of presentations you lose what you really wanted to say. So I want to start with my 3 points. My 3 points are: one, access to care is not the same as accessing care, especially in HIV work. And I think we saw that in the Massachusetts example very well, and it's true for us. 60% of my clients come in knowing they have access to free medical care, but have not accessed it in at least a year. So all of my clients have been out of services for at least a year, and 60% of them were absolutely yes. Either they had insurance, they had their Medicaid card already, they had other insurance, or they knew because they'd previously accessed it that they could get Ryan White services for free just by showing up. So that, to me, is an amazing statement about what we have to still be concerned about, even as we move to having more access in the Affordable Care Act, that There is a reason for HIV exceptionalism. It is not, just having that access is not enough. So that's the first point. The second point comes off of Louisiana. If you're going to use data, like surveillance data, Ryan White data, et cetera, the databases must talk to each other and synchronize. That you must be able to bring all of those pieces together, and you have to go back and check that all your reporters are doing what they're supposed to do. So we have, in Missouri, we have a statewide requirement that all CD4 and all viral load tests have to report to the state. Once we started looking at the list of people who had not had viral loads in the last year, we found that two of the major providers of HIV care in our region were not reporting their viral loads to the state ever. So we had 1,000 people on the lost to care list that were not lost to care. They just hadn't had their viral loads reported. We dropped the unmet need from 44% to 34%, and 10% drop in our region just by eliminating those people who were already in care, just by saying they're already there, they're just not in our systems. So that is a really important thing. And then our third point is something that is unique to our specific access to care program in St. Louis, and that is that we are using a community health nurse who goes out and meets with clients wherever they need it, in their own homes, in a community center, in a library, wherever they want to meet with her. And what we have found is that there is a barrier of distrust of the medical system, of having been treated poorly by some medical provider in the past. Either a great example is we have a client who was raped when she was 16, and that's how she acquired HIV. And when she went in and had her first experience with an HIV provider, basically he discounted the idea that she had been raped and said, oh, well, you probably got it from one of your other partners. And that was so devastating to her that she left and didn't go back and see a doctor until about six years when I was seeing her. And we had the nurse go out and meet with her for a series of 3 months before we even tried to get her a doctor's appointment again, just to build that rapport. And the community nurses have not been integrated into HIV care in many places, and we really think it's a powerful part of what we're doing. So those are three things as I go through the rest. So we are a collaborative program. We had to call us the Beacon Project Barrier Elimination and Care Navigation Project because we got a cease and desist letter from a local organization that calls itself Access to Care. So we came up with another name for us, and that's what we came up with. We've served, as of the end of August, we'd served 195 clients in St. Louis. Again, very similar in terms of the demographics, majority male, 72%, transgender, 4%. And that, I think the transgender percentage, they're all male to female transgender, is an important one. When we compare that to the Ryan White database for our region, in the Ryan White database, the percentage of male to female transgenders is only 1%. And we are getting 4% in our data. And when I talk to other access to care sites around the country, I hear a higher percentage of transgender than is what the norm in Ryan White databases is. This is important. I think it's pointing us in a direction that especially male to female transgenders are not accessing care at the same levels, that they're more likely to be lost to care. African American, 74%, which is pretty indicative of the way the epidemic looks like in St. Louis. Average time since last HIV special appointment, 3.8 years. So most of these people are out of care about 4 years. Time since diagnosis, 7.8. Median CD4 at intake is 218. We have 45% of our clients come in as new AIDS diagnoses. So the last time they were in care, they did not have an AIDS diagnosis. Their CD4 was above 200. When they come to us, their CD4 is under. So that's a really frightening statistic, that we really should not have that many new AIDS diagnoses. Mean viral load at intake is 320,000, so really matches what the national is. And I think the thing about that is I had not really seen many assays of 10 million or more viral loads until I started this program. And that I see regularly clients come in at 10 million and above as their, above 10 million as their viral load. We use a very similar model, intensive case management, two HIV positive peers in each team, and a community health nurse. Now, the role of community health nurse, as I said, that is one of, I think, our key value added to this whole national discussion. They're so useful when we have clients with comorbidities. For someone like me, one of the elephants that's been around in HIV since the early days, basically anything that you throw at me in HIV, I pretty much have seen it at some point and dealt with it. But these other comorbidities, I am not a health professional. And so to have understanding of that in the non-clinical setting, so outside of who they're seeing as a medical provider, is really important for clients to make that translation of what they're hearing in the clinical appointments into their actual day-to-day work. Literally sitting in the apartment saying, you should eat more of this, you should eat less of that, you know, this is when you should take your medicines, here's how your pill box should look, here's how you know to remind us, just those tiny things, but are huge. Over, as I mentioned before, overcoming the distrust of medical providers, a huge issue. and communication among providers, so that the community nurse accompanies the client to the doctor's appointment with the HIV specialist and to the cancer, the oncology appointment, and can discuss back and forth, can bring the information that the client is not necessarily so good at bringing back and forth between those. The other thing I think that's really important, if you know anything about HIV, is this piece of the money. Since we are not funded by Ryan White, we are not limited by what Ryan White will fund. So if we have a client who has been getting to all their appointments, doing everything they need to do, riding their bicycle, and their bicycle breaks, I can buy them a new bicycle out of this money. I can get them a state ID, $7 for a state ID in Missouri. Without that state ID, there's no way for them to get other services. And there's no way an existing Ryan White to pay for that. So having this funding source, and we're really reporting back to Ryan White saying, you need to have a little bit more flexibility on what you can spend money on, because it's going to have a huge impact on clients. So lessons learned, as I said, surveillance data is a tool for finding lots of care and never in care. We had a big failure. And the reason we had a big failure is the surveillance data was not accurate, multiple databases did not interact, and surveillance data was very, very difficult to use. So understand, I know at U.S. Conference on AIDS this year, there were a lot of presentations on using surveillance data for loss of care, and it's great if you have, like Louisiana, a system that works. If you're someplace where it's not working, surveillance data is not going to get you where you want to go. And then the final, I'll just end where I began, access to healthcare is not the same as accessing healthcare. This, to me, is the message that everyone interested in HIV should be saying everywhere, all the time, over the next year as we implement ACA, that just that access is not enough. We have to have all the support and wraparound services and knowledge and stigma-ending processes that allow people to actually make it through the door to the doctor. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much, Steve. Access is not access. I'm going to say that forever. So let's go from the heartland to Los Angeles. And Stella Gukasian is going to give us an overview of the AIDS Project Los Angeles findings. And Stella holds a master's degree in human development and psychology from Harvard Graduate School of Education and a bachelor's degree in biology from the University of California, San Diego. In the last decade, she's been working in the field of international and domestic HIV/AIDS. Her work in program management and evaluation includes international projects at the Harvard Center for AIDS Research, and most recently, the project that she'll discuss right now at AIDS Project Los Angeles. Thank you.
Hello, everyone. So cold this morning. It's hard getting used to. So I just wanted to quickly give you an overview of our project. I'm just going to jump to the slide, but explain something that when we were funded to do this work through AIDS United, we thought that we would partner with some of our local NGOs who do work, you know, with youth, with homeless populations, etc. But we realized getting a match fund was really difficult, so we partnered with our Department of Public Health, which then had other structural and difficult issues. So now we have two arms of the project, and I just wanted to make that very clear that I'm going to discuss only the arm that's at our community-based organization at AIDS Project Los Angeles, and not the other arm, which is at the county clinics, which sort of is a different model. So just going to give you an example of patient navigation in the context of HIV, and our recruitment is in reach, so we're in-house recruitment through the different departments that we have, and some outcome highlights. So here we are, just sort of the medical culture and the systems, as everyone's been talking about, and that access to healthcare, and also the patient culture and community that accessing healthcare. And our navigator is the bridge. I know this looks really simple, but it is a really tough job. Our navigators are fabulous people who have been in the field for many years, and these folks basically are linking and hoping to retain folks in care. And basically, they understand the HIV treatment model, and they help folks access these resources that are available that they may not be able to access otherwise. They develop communication with providers. For example, one of our clients came in a few weeks ago and said, you know, I have a doctor's appointment. I have no idea how to tell my doctor I hate the treatment I'm on. So our navigator literally said, no problem. That's your need right now, even though I want to ask you about these 2,000 other questions I have. Let's sit down and write something. Would it help you to write something? Of course, I don't have a computer, but no problem. I'll use my laptop to type up something for you, print it out, you practice, whatever. Take it with you, say this is what I want. So that was kind of very helpful for that particular client. That's what our navigators do sometimes, not just simple things, but they actually, you know, help them have those conversations with doctors, even accompanying them to the medical appointments. So they have very good communication with providers and then help them sort of meet their needs and barriers. Very important for our community in Los Angeles, our navigators are, except for one, all bilingual. And the one that's not bilingual works for with youth. So bilingual is really important because a lot of our folks are undocumented, and a fifth, I would say, if not more, are monolingual. So those are very difficult challenges, and they're very happy to speak with someone who understands where they're coming from, especially in the language they're comfortable with. They're culturally competent. Like I said, a lot of our navigators come from the community and are either positive themselves or have worked for many years with this community. They're sensitive to the needs, and they communicate really well with the clients and other colleagues. And the very, very difficult system to navigate in Los Angeles, they're very familiar with. So the one thing about our program that's interesting is we did this intensive trainings in the beginning, which involved the artist training from the California Office of AIDS. We had folks come out for a three-day training. We did MI trainings, which I think are very helpful for our navigators in the conversations they're having to with clients to keep it sort of, if any of you have done MI, I'm sure you have, just kind of strength-based and I can't really explain it. It's a three-day training, but you kind of understand. Sorry. Treatment education is another really important component. We really emphasize adherence in our treatment education. We found that a lot of our folks, on average, have been diagnosed 9 years ago, kind of what the national sites have as well. And their issue is that their viral loads just kind of go all over the place. And adherence is a big issue, especially in Los Angeles with homelessness, et cetera. And, you know, IRB and HIPAA, all of those trainings. One thing with us is we have a clinical supervisor who is a mental health specialist, and he attends all of our weekly meetings to sit with our navigators, and we do case presentations to debrief about difficult cases. And a lot of times our cases are extremely difficult emotionally on our navigators, and so they go through that. And we have weekly meetings with our team. So this is kind of our model, just the inReach. We have the recruitment process through our food bank, which in our case, we have a nutritionist. So she, you know, people will come in, that's their basic need. So they come in looking for food. Oh, we heard APLA gives food. Well, not until you register and meet with the nutritionist and you go to these classes. So in that way, we kind of have their attention. Hey, you will get food at the end of today, but are you in care or have you seen a doctor? Those are some of our screening questions we ask our nutritionists to sort of talk about with the individual. We've gotten a lot of referrals from that sort of conversation. Case management is also another department that we have. We've gotten a lot of referrals from them. Home health, some referrals, because most of those folks have the nurses that go out to their homes, and so we meet them there. Benefits and housing are big for us. Housing is a huge problem in Los Angeles, and so a lot of folks have that need that they come in for, and again, our housing specialists are trained to sort of screen for that if they're in care, and then literally from the third floor, they walk them down to the second floor to meet with our navigators, and it works really well. Testing and mental health are also two other departments that really do well in recruiting folks, and our dental, also we've started sort of implementing those screenings in our dental clinics, and so hopefully we'll get more referrals from there. We've put a case manager in the clinic so he can actually talk to folks about this. What we do is we identify, so at enrollment, we identify the barriers and the needs through the baseline assessment and the individual service plan, which highlights the goals, similar to, I think, the Boston Project. We highlight goals, et cetera, with a client, of course, meeting them where they're at, and sort of implement the patient navigator intervention, depending, of course, again, where the client is. And then it's all about the linkage. And for most folks, if they're linked in care, they might not, it's happened, I think, like 60% of the time that we've transferred clinics or physicians for folks, and that's been something that they wouldn't be able to do for themselves. So we've kind of helped them bridge that gap. And then just identifying patterns of management for their care, what factors may lead them to being out of care or in suboptimal care, et cetera. So that's kind of our retention follow-up piece. Like I said, we are coordinated outside of inside of our APLA Geffen Center. We have a few sites, but we mainly work out of this one. And our folks are available to meet people across. One thing about our program is we have incentives. It's a Target gift card. And we thought, oh, just because we have incentives, people are going to run to us. You know, it's going to be a great way to. Some people have said, you know, you can keep the incentive for other folks who need it more. It's not been the fear that we had, like, oh, people are just going to come to us and try to get the incentive and then not really be engaged. We haven't seen that happen, and it's $80 in total for four sessions. And there are four sessions because we have the Johns Hopkins evaluation on a national level where we ask baseline 6 month, 12, and 18-month questions. But we also have folks who've come in 16 times. On average, folks come in about 10 times to meet with our NAVs, but a minimum of four is what is required for this sort of intervention. And just to say that even though we have the national across all sites, we also at the local level ask about stigma, which is we've noticed very huge because there was a measure on the national level that asked, I forget the four questions now, sorry, but not at all was what people were answering. Lots of were like, oh, that's not an issue for you. No, it's not an issue because I haven't told, oh, how many friends have you told? Oh, because I haven't told anyone. That's why it's not at all. So we put a disclosure sort of and piece in there to look at stigma, and it's been helpful because we found out that a lot of folks haven't told anyone about their status. Another piece that we've included is incarceration. It's huge in our community. A lot of our folks are post-incarcerated, so we've started asking from the beginning. And adherence. We do an adherence scale to just look at what people, it's a self-report, of course. We're not doing MCATs or anything like that, but that's been helpful for us. Homelessness. That's another question we ask at a local level. And just to go back to what Vignetta had mentioned about the cost analysis piece, when we did our cost analysis, 0.92 infections need to be averted in order for this, of 6 months of service, in order for this program to be cost effective and cost saving. And just looking at some of our data, we have 75 folks enrolled between September of last year to the end of October, and all of our folks have been linked into medical care within 30 days, which we're really proud of because our navigators have really good relationships with our physicians. They can literally call some of them up on their cell phones and say, hey, someone just walked in, and this is what they need. Do you have an appointment? And it's not going to take 2 months. It's not going to take 3 months. It's going to be quick because they have that rapport with the physicians. 64 of our clients out of those 75 were due for their six-month assessment. We started a little later than the other programs because of our structural barriers in the county, so that's why our numbers may look a little lower, but 65 were due for their assessment. 48, which is 75%, have completed those 6 months, and of those 48, 43 are retained in care. And I'll go over this, 30% were undetectable at baseline, and now at time one, 53% are undetectable. Most of our folks are male, as you can see there, very common across sites. Some of our preliminary viral load, here's what our change in median viral load looked like. In the beginning at baseline, folks were at 220. I know that doesn't look like much, but when I'm purposely doing median because when I did the mean, we had a lot of outliers, so that was throwing us off. So that's 43 folks. And then our CD4, we went up. Of course, we're trending in the right direction in all of those outcomes. And this is our undetectable viral load, as you can see. That's it. Sorry. Yeah, I thought I had to put it at the end, but thankfully you had done it too. Awesome.
Thanks, Stella. And our final presenter is from New York and is going to talk about the Access New York Project and patient-centered approaches to strengthening linkage to care. The presenter is Peter Misery. He's a medical sociologist and professor at the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia. He's been involved in numerous HIV-AIDS-related research and program evaluation projects since the late 80s. And today, his presentation is based on data collected for the CHAIN Project, a public academic partnership that has provided evaluation studies for New York City's HIV Health and Planning Council. And Dr. Misery has been the PI since 1984.
Thank you, Vignette. Let me make one correction. I it may be an error in my biography.
Yeah,
I'm the principal investigator chain project, but this data comes from MediCare and Access New York. This would be another presentation if I was to present on the chain project. Now for something almost completely different. My ability to present today's panel was almost by accident. I got lucky, and I found out that after about a year of working with my colleagues at Amedicare, I actually collected the way the data or the way the project turned out to be implemented allowed me to do a kind of outcomes-oriented evaluation that I actually didn't think I was able to do when I started the project. So today, I'm going to be able to present some results from the Health Navigator component of the AmediCare's Positive Charge Project, Access New York. To anticipate the findings, they were mixed. In particular, we found that the assignment of a Health Navigator did in fact reduce the time to initial visit for the clients. On the other hand, a little bit more disturbingly, it actually also was associated with a subsequent risk of dropping out of care. At this point, if I was to do this presentation, I would say we need more research. But in the last few weeks, I learned about a turn that occurred among my colleagues who've known about this finding for about 9 months. They, in fact, took the lessons learned rather seriously. And as I'm going to describe, they responded to my evidence-based practice with practice-based evidence, which has actually allowed them to take that lesson learned and revise their model in ways that we hope will prove more successful. And I actually want to use this time to describe that turn. So let me turn to my presentation. The first thing I want to do is to throw up a definition of patient navigation. Why do that? Because we all use it, and I happened to come across a Judy Bradford definition, which I thought was pretty cool, although each of us may have our own, and I tend to believe when it comes to things like patient navigation, like its closely related idea of care coordination, and perhaps the more distant relationship with pornography, this is something we best not define, but it's something we know when we see it. The other thing I'd like to point out, and to keep attention to this in this presentation, is that although some notion of patient navigation runs through the threads of all these and other access to care, notice the variations in some very important ways. And I'm going to make some points about this as we continue. So, the point I think we all sort of forget about patient navigation, or at least from the perspective of research, this is something that's done widely, but the evidence base is actually relatively thin. Patient health navigators, in fact, were something that's first employed in cancer care. In fact, there's a patient navigation center sometime this afternoon that I thought I'd attend to see what's up in that disease areas. And as has already been pointed out, the only randomized clinical trial on HIV that has tested some notion of patient navigation is the ARTIST project, which, as you see, has disseminated to at least two of our projects. Other people may also know that the SPINS Outreach Initiative also provides some information about the impact of patient initiative, and here they use something of a quasi-experimental experiment to demonstrate the impact of patient navigation. And in both cases, we do find some impact from both these studies. And if someone knows some other outcome evaluations related to patient navigation, please let me know, because we've been trying over the last year to find that additional literature in HIV. What I want to emphasize to get started with this is when we think about patient navigation, we also have to think about who in fact hires the patient navigation, what population is being targeted, and something about the duration of contact. Those are the three parameters that I, in particular, have become interested about. In our case, the health navigators, we call them health navigators, patient navigators, we also have community outreach workers to throw in the mix, but I'm going to use the term health navigators throughout, are actually employees of a managed care plan. In this case, a New York City Medicaid HIV special needs health plan, Amedicare. And I make that point because, again, if you think carefully about this in other presentation, where typically do we put care coordination? And care coordination up till now has basically come at maybe the State Department of Health, local Department of Health, or private foundations and aid service organizations. And they also generously supported as demonstration projects. One of the questions that I struggle with after the fact, as a policy issue, if we think they're good, what is the long-term maintenance and sustainability of these programs? And a natural place might, in fact, look at health insurance plans, particularly in the ACA and Medicaid managed care. They're an interesting actor to explore the viability of health navigators and others. And the other question is, all these things we're looking at dropped out of care. And here's the other point. As originally conceived, there was a 90-day limit. So what do we do? Access to care is, again, a linkage in care project. And the only thing I want to say, we combine both a patient-focused and a system change component, and I'm not going to say much about the Learning Collaborative, except it's an effort to provide training among our clinics in continuous quality improvement. When I talk about client-focused services, there are a range of focuses, and I'm just picking out the most intensive, the patient navigator. But the insurance company, Amedicare, does an awful lot to try to engage and keep track of their clients through a range of incentives and outreach activities that I won't attempt to summarize today. So why are I got fortunate about the data? The first thing is that health plans happen to collect a lot of administrative data that's very useful for measuring things such as retention, linkage to care, medications, and test results. But what was really good for me was exactly how they assigned the patient navigators. In this case, it turns out we had more demand than patient navigators. And my colleagues at Medicare simply went down the list and sort of signed some of those people, sort of working at the top of their list of people who were eligible to down. And I asked them about how this list was organized. And they say, it's a list that's generated by the computer. And as I pressed them, I realized that there was really no great structure to this list. They had no real information why they should assign one as others. And although there are some problems with this approach, I'm going to claim that this is as good as random. I then used my statistical magic through proportional hazard analysis and odds ratios to estimate the effect of assignment of a health navigator on various outcomes. So what did we find? Between July 2010 and December 2011, Medicare identified 1,105 of their members who were eligible for Access New York. That's to say, they had dropped out of care. Of that group, 345 were actually assigned a health navigator, and 40% of the health navigators actually made successful contact. Over a six-month period after enrollment, 90% were linked to care. At 1 year post-enrollment, 80% were retained in care, 62% on ARC, and 48% had viral suppression using a relatively demanding cut point. But these are the data I want to show you about. These are odds ratios. And let me first talk about first visit. What this is telling us, after assignment to a health navigator, reduce the time to initial visit among our dropped out of care population by about 40%. And that represents an average reduction from about 95 days to 70 days. And although the next arrow looks like it's in the right direction, this is really going in the reduction. Because our next question was asked, after they made their initial visit, how long did they stay in care? And what I'm measuring here is the risk of a lapse in care of more than 6 months. and point out that odds ratio represents an increased risk of a lapse of care. That's the dropping out of almost 2. And I tried as best I could, and I couldn't eliminate it. So I'll go back to this, this mixed result. I also want to show you some more additional information to confirm this finding that essentially the way we configured patient navigators, we got the people in the door, but not much further. And what we're seeing is over the first 6 months, the health navigator was associated with an increase in ART use, but notice it disappears by the time we get up to 12 and 18 month follow-up. Similarly, getting test orders also increased during the 6 month, but declined thereafter. No real effect on viral suppression, although overall the project tended to have rather strong results. So what did this tell us in terms of my evidence and ultimately how this translates to practice-based evidence? As I said, the basic finding is, as configured, the health navigators seem to be successful in getting clients into the clinic door, but not much further. I proposed at that point the argument that somehow we're nudging people into the door, but not doing much after that to keep them in the door. And as I was told, there was this 3-month limitation, which sort of confirmed my submissions. Now, at this point, as I said, I would stop and say more research. But my colleagues at Amedicare were interested in these findings, and they, in fact, began to explore these results with their health navigators and CHOWs. And in point of fact, when they were focused attention on my statistical findings, they began to generate information which suggests, you know, maybe we're not spending enough time with our clients. And they, in fact, produced little kinds of information that was shared with me that sort of confirmed this fact in various ways, that the people with HIV, their clients, really had not gained enough sense of self-management to be able to carry on. And in the spirit of mixed methods, they both used quantitative and qualitative to see how, this led them to sort of open it up and make more flexible. The director of the program is here. He can answer your questions about this revision. But essentially, the program is now opened up with a much more open-ended approach to the length of the relationship. And in the spirit of mixed methods, the staff is now collecting quantitative and qualitative to see how the new model's working. And maybe down the road, they'll let me look at the data again to see whether it really worked.
I'm about done. We are actually looking at other care coordination models that are focused on narrowly our members with substance abuse and mental illness problem. And I want to end a sort of pitch with Amedicare. In an era in which we increasingly choose healthcare plans within provider networks, health plans seem to be an underexplored actor to be able to actually implement and perhaps ultimately support the national HIV strategies of a seamless system of continuous and coordinated care. Thank you.
Thanks, Peter. And before I open it up for questions, I just wanted to highlight that one of the reasons that AIDS United has chosen the model that we have is for exactly what Peter identified, which is if you have a local evaluator who is working closely with the project, sometimes they can identify those things sort of mid-course, and the program itself can evolve to better train the clients, but also to make sure that we're doing the best that we can for the communities that we want to serve. So it's not just more research is necessary, although, you know, as a PhD, I will always say that, but it is also that the research is informing the practice, and practice will evolve. And so then the more research that is necessary will perhaps be different. These various models that we've talked about today, they have some common themes, but again, they've never been a one-size-fits-all, and I think that that's true of HIV, but also beyond. And so what we often say at AIDS United is the lessons of HIV, and specifically the lessons from access to care, can be adapted to other disease states, and you can certainly see that. And we're certainly seeing that with partners now in trauma and mental health, with cardiovascular disease, with our friends, our kissing cousin, hepatitis, and certainly with other chronic conditions like diabetes. So I'd like to thank our panelists again for their presentation. And open it up for any questions. If you have no questions, I have one. Moderator's prerogative. So I would like to ask, actually, all of you, you've done this work. We have some partners in the audience, in fact, who have done this work with you. And if you were to do it all over again, what would you change about your project? I don't know if I can move this.
You can start going
first. Yeah. Okay. Can everyone hear me, or should I stand up? Okay, awesome. I think for us, buy-in and data collection, it was really tough to get folks who've been doing this work for many years to begin collecting the data in the way we were asking them to collect the data, because it seemed really tough. So I had to build a lot of relationships, and I'm the only one on our team, so it was like, be my friend, please. Don't hate me because I'm asking you to do 2,000 things, aside from all the other things you're doing. So I think just setting up the data collection ahead of time, because it takes a lot of effort. But it's really good.
Ours was the importance of training. We had constant training. It was quarterly to work with the peer navigators and to refine, like you said, the models to lessons learned or to reflect and incorporate those changes into the program, but also in doing that to document those changes. So kind of having an intentional, like a program manual sort of running up front, because now we're actually doing the program manual now, and we're kind of retrospectively, we're looking at the notes and we're, you know, kind of doing it and then doing validation, going back to them and saying, okay, is this, you know, how it worked along the way. But having that along, that documentation, so you can get that sort of ongoing credit, because, you know, when you do the program refinements, you're not necessarily getting the credit for those changes along the way. So I think a program manual is really good to have as an intentional product up front.
I think I would have interrogated thoroughly the holders of all the databases that we were going to try to get information from to find a client. So if there had been a way to sort of not just take what when the city said to us, the health department said, oh, we have this wonderful list of people who are lost to care, to really interrogate them about what that list was, where it was coming from, how recently it had been double-checked or cleaned against other existing databases. I think that we probably lost 3 or 4 months at the beginning of the project where we were really stumbling around because we thought that somehow this list of lost to care was out there and available in our region when it really did not exist.
Actually, can I ask a follow-up to that? So I do feel like, you know, we've used the Louisiana example of systems integration, which was supported by a SPIN project, a special project of national significance. So, of course, that can't necessarily be replicated in every community. And so do you feel like if you had, I don't know, 6, 9 months, a year, you could have ever made that change within St. Louis with your health department?
I believe that we could have gotten a lot closer. If we had not tried to do any other programmatic thing and had just spent a year on the list, making sure that everyone was reporting in the way they were supposed to, making sure that, you know, cross-check that, you know, when people moved, when people died, they were getting off that list, and then begun to have a conversation about how, you know, we have the Ryan White database, we have the surveillance database, we have the other database, of building a partnership of those databases discussing, which is something we have as a long-term goal as a follow-up to the project. We sort of had to get in the business of getting people in, because that's what we were getting all this money to do. And so we had to sort of let that go and say we've done as much as we can. And cleaning the list, it really, you know, that was, the health department in St. Louis loves us, in part because we pointed out to them all the problems that were with their existing surveillance data, and actually, again, as I said in my intro, helped reduce their unmet need that they report to HRSA from 44% to 34% unmet need. So they see that as just a huge success. For us, like, we'll take it as a success, but it's not what we want to do. We wanted to reduce the unmet need by actually getting people in the door and get them into care. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think maybe a pre-project Hey, if you're thinking about using surveillance data for loss to care, your first step is working on the data before you plan any of the other interventions, and we just didn't do that.
I think for us in Boston, there's so many clinical sites, and so really developing formal partnerships with the clinical sites beforehand would be very important. We've kind of started developing that now that we're more into the project. It's helped clients get into the door, get appointments faster. It's helped us know how clients are doing and stay on top of the clients a little bit more. But that's not something we had initially, and so it was something we had informally. You know, a case manager would have a relationship with somebody over here, but then another case manager or agency wouldn't have that relationship. So now it's a little bit more formalized. We know where we can get people in, how long it's going to take them to get an appointment, and we can get them that quickly, and then know what's going on.
What can I say? I got lucky. Meeting here did all the hard work. They put together, before I got there, a network of over 65 primary care practices, and they provide me with essentially the integrated data set that everyone else applies for.
Lucky Peter Musseri. I'm still not seeing any hands. I'm going to ask one last question because we have a, oh, I'm sorry. There you go.
Two phases of that. We do a lot of community outreach. Since we didn't have a list, we would go out to churches, to community centers, and often what we said there was, if there's anybody in your family circle, if there's anybody you know who is not in, who's HIV positive, not in care, is disclosed to you, come send them to us. So we did try to reach out to those people in that way. We found actually though that our most effective way to get people not in care in was to go and speak to groups of HIV positive folks who are actually in care. So things like the planning councils and the community advisory boards, they all had friends who were not in care because of some flaw in the existing system that had pushed them away. And by saying there's a new way, a new process, we're not doing it the same old way we got them in. Now once we have a client in, if they have a family member who wants education, we use the HIV positive peer navigator to provide that. We'll do that in the home. If they need specific medical, our community nurse will go in and do training on, you know, there's, you know, exactly how transmission happens and those sorts of things, and what they might expect when their loved one is on meds and how that's going to work. So that would be done by the community health nurse. And stigma piece would be done more by the peer navigators.
Kevin? And I can be interested in your answer to that question.
Yeah. You can be now. Go ahead. Yeah, absolutely. Speak for us.
Well, because we are an insurance company, Medicaid Managed Care Plan, we connect families in a very different way than the community-based organization would. So certainly because of HIPAA violations, we have a lot of our members who aren't necessarily out to their family that their HIV status. So it's a very different atmosphere that we have. And we do can work with families in our navigation program if the member wants us to, but it's more limited because we are not actually a community-based organization. We are for this, you know, we're funded through Medicaid for the services of that person.
Stella?
Yeah, so for us we do a lot of disclosures or now sit down, you know, our folks come in and say, hey, like my partner doesn't know, my mom doesn't know, et cetera. They'll bring folks in and they'll literally go through it and explain what HIV is. We do have a few serious coordinated couples who, you know, they ask for their partner to be present. And they may know their status, but they don't know how to prevent transmission. So yeah, they do a little bit.
I have a question about, I guess, the piece of data that seems to run across all of the sites is this issue about people having a diagnosis around about 8 years ago. Some of them may be only out of care for 3 or 4 years. But I'm curious, for many people in Cleveland, where I work, when they drop out of care and when they've been positive for a while, quite often they've gone on to substance abuse, mm-hmm. binges, right? I'm just curious, I didn't hear much today from you all about that, and I'd love to hear more about your interactions with people around substance abuse and they're coming in and out of residential treatment, and we deal so much with that sobriety model of treatment, so when we try to do harm reduction, there's a lot of kind of clashing. So if anybody could reflect on that, that'd be great.
Sorry, USCA had slides about that, but I took it out for this because we have less time. But yes, crystal meth is a huge issue in Los Angeles. And in fact, the mean for our viral load was like 35,000 because we had folks that were in the 10 millions, et cetera. But I used the median in this presentation to avoid that sort of outlier thing. But we also had folks who started undetectable and went to 740,000, undetectable to 111,000, undetectable to 55,000 because they identified crystal use, et cetera. And the other issue with that is really hard to find them once we're at six. We're approaching 1 year, and the folks we can't find, literally, it's like crystal meth use. They've identified that because we do ask about substance use. So,
one of the big successes that we had that I didn't talk about in this is Ryan White in Missouri at the beginning of the program was not paying for substance abuse treatment as part of a Ryan White service. We actually got that to change by demonstrating how many of our loss to care folks self-identified substance use as a barrier to care. And so we actually were able to, that was one of our first systematic changes in the St. Louis region. But it is a huge problem, and it is, our client number one, actually, just got placed in a full-time residential program because every other program we tried to get him into, he'd always, when they you know, drug test him in, he got excluded. We got him through three or four different drug treatment centers, and now he's finally got housed like last month in a two to three year program. But it is a huge issue, and I don't have a good answer. But I think if one of our things we struggle with is how do we do that coordination? Because we have active heroin users in our program who are taking their meds and going to the doctor visits. And it's like, well, you know, from my point of view, that's success. Like, you may want to get on, you know, you may want some substance use treatment, but if you don't, you know, as long as, you know, you're undetectable viral load and going to your appointments, you know, however you're managing your life. So we do have that sort of, that's just what you're saying, that we are coming from a harm reduction model and we're coming from our focus as HIV. And so if it's not a problem for you, it's the same way we do the screener. If someone says that substances are not a problem for them, then they're not a problem for them. Like that, the case manager may identify as a barrier, substance abuse is a problem. But if the client doesn't identify as a need, that's then, you know, that place where you have to have that dialogue. And can you, you know, and if they are that client who can be an active user and do HIV care, we've sort of reached the end of our issue with it. Now, if we find out over time, like, they're missing appointments, they're drunk and not making it to it, then we do some intervention about, well, we're really concerned about your health. And it seems like this, even though you're not saying that substance use is a problem for you, it seems like it's interfering with you taking care of HIV health. And that's our wedge in.
I think all of the access to care is a recovery and relapse model, right? So, you know, like, so it's whether you're a substance abuser or not, right? It's just, it's hard to manage a chronic condition for all of your life, and so people will recover and relapse, and then if you have substance abuse issues on top of that, then certainly that's an added layer. But almost all of our access to care components certainly address substance abuse through it.
Good morning. I'm sorry, I came late, so I missed the whole recording session. I'm from Philadelphia. This idea of patient advocate is wonderful. It's a wonderful idea. It's not old, or, you know, it's not new, but unfortunately for us in Philadelphia, working HIV, it is. So for those of you who are using patient advocates or health advocates or whatever you want to call them, if you're using grants to support this, well, if you're not using grants to support their position, what are you doing to support, sustain that program, and what's your, like, you know, ROI, like, what's your measures?
Well, the sustainability is a big issue for everybody, of course, with funding now these days. And of the embedded model, I think, in terms of having cross-train. And so then you would hope that beyond the funding period that the clinics will pick up a component or at least partial of their FTEs will be split because they do cross-train in other areas. So addressing substance abuse and addressing HIV, addressing homelessness and housing and other issues, if they're cross-trained in all these other issues as a wraparound model, then they're basically more employable. That's kind of one major approach that we want to make sure they're not siloed in their approaches. And then the systems being set up in a way that they're sustainable, because it just doesn't just benefit HIV care. It benefits all these other things that it's connected to. This is, you know, pure public health, right? We know that everything's connected. So having those things be, you know, long-term is another outcome. And then the advocacy pieces, having these coalition groups come together and having them meet, lots of volunteer time. I mean, lots of volunteer time. We go to a lot of meetings, and, you know, I'm on a planning council, so, you know, it's just there's a constant role on different needs, because as you address some needs, then others will crop up. So having those subgroups and those work groups that are connected and working together on a more long-term basis is a definite strategy for sustainability. But yeah, funding is, yeah. And you can't get around the funding issue.
We're using the CAPAS grant to continue after the Age United money to try it. And we also are working really hard with Planning Council to get peers into. We already have some treatment adherence peers that are already paid for through Rhineway, and we're trying to get now more patient navigation paid for through there. We're also, probably with the changes in Rhineway, St. Louis is going to be piloting a whole new model of access to services through Rhineway, where we're going to really change who's a case manager and what the role is. And part of that is going to be the introduction of community health workers who are going to be primarily HIV positive peers. In Philadelphia, the one thing I would recommend, because I know you have a very strong people living with HIV network, is get ACT UP Philadelphia to get on this. Get everybody get her on it and get her saying this is really important. You saw it that other places are doing it successfully and the Rhino is paying for it. And, you know, get all those folks to that meeting. And I think I'm surprised in Philadelphia that it's not being used, because they have such a strong people living with HIV caucus that there's no reason you should be putting pressure on the local funders to make it happen.
And Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services, if your state is expanding Medicaid, there's an opt-in to get, right, but there's an opt-in to get, yes, exactly, yeah. And then, there is an option, and then your child's could be Medicaid reimbursable, which is then a more sustainable level of investment than a grant from AIDS United. Thank you so much for your participation, and thank you again to our presenters.